I'm here with Ian Clark, and Ian has done a number of interesting things in the past, particularly around file sharing and then also, I guess, building an interesting video site. And Ian's here to tell us a little bit about that and also his latest startup. So he does have a little bit of an unfortunate accent, so I hope you can put up with the Irishness here. But aside from that, he's a nice guy, and I'd like to introduce Ian Clark.
I will do my best to water down my accent as much as possible so that people can
as
understand me.
I'm on a bounce and make fun of your accent.
Touché.
So tell us about yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm an engineer by trade. I have a degree in artificial intelligence and computer science from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. The initial project that really set my career trajectory was and is a project called Freenet, which grew out of some work I did at university on decentralized systems. And Freenet is a 501c3 nonprofit, and the intent was and is to allow people in countries like China and Saudi Arabia to exchange information without fear of censorship by their government. And Freenet has kind of been an ongoing side project for me for the last 7 years. But in parallel with it, I've started several commercial ventures. The first was called Uprizer. Uprizer developed a peer-to-peer content distribution technology. I left Uprizer in 2002 and set up a consulting company called Somatics, and probably the best-known project that Somatics worked on was with Jan Sfrith and Nicholas Zentrum. They had previously founded Kazaa and Skype, and I worked on a peer-to-peer video distribution technology that now forms part of a piece of software called Juiced. Subsequent to that, I had always been very interested in the concept of how to allow people to monetize their creative efforts online, and I realized that advertising was not the first to realize this, but that advertising was a pretty effective way to do that. And together with two co-founders, we started a company called Rever. Rever was the first online video company to attach advertising to the end of videos and share the revenue with content creators. Rever raised, $10 million in A and B round financing. I moved on from Rever in December 2006 to start my current venture, which is called Thoof, T-H-O-O-F. And the idea of Thoof very simply is to figure out what people want and give it to them and offer that capability as a service to third parties.
All right, so that's a mouthful there. You've raised a million questions when I ask you about all this stuff, and I think that the kind of funny thing is that you were telling me before we got started here that you were unsure whether you were really fit for the call and you know, whether you'd done the right stuff, and I think anyone listening can see that Ian quite sad, and you've done some impressive things. So I want to ask you about them because you've done very cool stuff. So I didn't know you what you did with Freenet and then learning about peer-to-peer sharing. That's actually become part of Juiced?
No, so Freenet has not become part of Juiced. The thing that became part of Juiced came quite a bit after Freenet. That was developed by my consulting company. I was approached by Janis Friss. This was actually shortly before they launched Skype. Janis approached me and asked me if I could build a technology that would distribute live video over a peer-to-peer network to minimize the central server bandwidth requirements, which is generally what peer-to-peer is good at in this type of scenario. And so I built a technology which did that over the next 2 years, and we handed that off in mid-2006 to the team that then became Juiced. So that project kind of is at the heart of what is now Juiced.
And so you've written a bunch of code that Juiced are now using?
I believe so, yes. I hope they didn't. I hope they didn't rewrite it. But yes, I believe they're now using our peer-to-peer video distribution code.
Cool. And so that was just a consulting project you worked on for a year, or so was it?
Yeah, that was about 2 years. I kind of started off working on that full time, then I kind of gradually got distracted more and more by Rever, which was also kind of getting going around that time.
All right, why don't you tell us a bit about Rever? I mean, as I understand it, it's basically a YouTube clone with a differentiator that people putting videos up there get a revenue share of the advertising money generated from their videos. Is that a correct summary?
Pretty correct. It is similar to YouTube in that it's kind of part of the latest crop of video sharing websites. Although we weren't aware of YouTube. We were pretty well underway when YouTube launched, so it wasn't quite a me too.
But did you have it before YouTube?
We started working on it in mid-2005. So yes, we'd kind of decided what we were going to build long before we were aware of YouTube.
When you started building it, how did you focus on driving traffic?
So it was interesting. Our approach was different to YouTube, and in retrospect, perhaps a mistake. Our hypothesis was that the way to build traffic is to form relationships with the creators. And this was kind of a big part of our motivation for sharing revenue with the video creators. And we felt that if we're financially incentivizing the creators, then they would, we would have the best content, and it's really the content that motivates people to come to your website. And subsequently, that's exactly what happened. Like some of Rever's biggest successes so far were a group called EB Bird created a video that you may recall from about a year and a half ago, where these guys in white lab coats.
The Mentos video, Mentos and Kirk.
Yeah,
man, I love that stuff.
Yeah, and they got onto, like, they were on the Letterman show and all sorts of stuff, and we got a lot of traffic from that. Lonely Girl 15 generated a lot of traffic for us, Zay Frank. So what we found was that because Rever was and is the website you go to if you actually want to get paid, we were able to attract these people who were, semi-professional video creators. And I think the problem that Rever always had was that this stuff would wind up on YouTube anyway because of YouTube's lax enforcement of copyright. So it wasn't quite as big a differentiator as we originally expected it to be.
Hmm. In hindsight, how would you, if you're starting over, how would you be driving traffic today?
I think the general approach was pretty sound. I think that we probably were a little bit late to market relative to YouTube. So I think really the what would have helped us a lot would have been, being 4 months earlier than we actually were.
Do you think it was just 4 months? You don't think it was anything else?
I think that it was a combination of things. So I think it would have been helpful to get to market a little bit earlier. It would have been helpful to be more exclusively focused on the challenge of attracting eyeballs, whereas instead of focusing on the video consumer exclusively, which is what most other video sharing websites did, at least from the first year of their existence, we were focused on three constituencies. We were focused on the consumer, we were focused on the content our focus was split between the consumer, the content creator, and the advertiser. We raised, a similar amount of money to some of our competitors, yet we were splitting our efforts between answering the needs of three types of user instead of just the video consumer.
Right. Just a perspective I have, just from some of the people that I talked to, I haven't gotten close to any of the YouTube guys, but I did an interview a couple of months ago with the guy who founded YouSendIt,
mm-hmm.
I think they were the ones that end up hosting like the Iraqi video and all kinds of stuff, which is very much viral driven, and now he runs Fly Upload, as well as knowing just some of the guys in the Bay Area who really focus on viral marketing, which I know that the YouTube guys did coming from PayPal. Is everything they did was around virally driving traffic. Apparently, the only thing that really worked virally was the fact that they could embed videos in web pages. They, apparently, of all the different stuff that was tested, that was the only one that actually worked really, really well. But then they had the other advantage, and this is what was really interesting from the YouSendIt guy. He said that every file that gets uploaded to YouSendIt, like a video or whatever, they'd encourage people to upload stuff and then put links in forums and all over the web and send it to their friends to download. And he said the average upload, and this is the average across the entire YouSendIt network, for every upload, the average is 60 downloads. That's network-wide. So that means every file that gets uploaded, it's being introduced to 60 new people. So that's very powerful viral marketing. And with YouTube not doing a copyright enforcement, you're then competing against Britney Spears and her videos getting uploaded. You're not allowing that kind of stuff, as I understand it anyway, whereas they are. And so people are going in and searching and finding all that stuff, and sort of their level of viralness is far stronger than yours, and so therefore their growth is orders of magnitude faster.
Yes, well, I think it's clearly an advantage if you're just going to ignore copyright. I think our thinking at the time was that YouTube was kind of destined to go down the route of Napster, which is, yes, they achieved viral growth because they're essentially, achieving it using material that they have not paid for and they're not rewarding. The people who created the material are not getting paid for it. It is certainly a lot easier when you're kind of able to piggyback on someone else's creativity in that regard. But that was, to kind of do that would be very much antithetical to what we wanted to be as a company.
So you, even say if you were starting over and we were back then when you were starting, you wouldn't take that approach?
I think if we were going to get to market before YouTube or at the same time as YouTube, and I think if our goal was, you know, if we were aware that you could grow at the speed they grew and then get acquired before, you know, anyone in the media really gets it together enough to sue you, you know, then clearly those guys made a lot of money and that would be a smart thing to do. But kind of given what we wanted to be at that time and given our perception at that time that, you know, you can't just build a business that is predicated on violating copyright, it wouldn't make sense. It turns out in retrospect that YouTube did build a business largely predicated on violating copyright.
Well, legal acts enforcement. I mean, I think they are legal, but it's in such a gray area that you could drive tanks through it.
Yeah, I mean, their enforcement. So the area that they kind of live in is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and it's, you could say it's lax enforcement, but the reality is that if they were effectively avoiding the distribution of copyrighted work for which they did not have permission to redistribute, I think it would have been a very different story.
I mean, you would have beaten them if they had been strictly enforcing copyright.
Yes, I think so, and I think that, or we would have beaten them if the entertainment industry had been a lot faster to move against them.
Right.
But you know, hindsight's 20/20.
Oh no, absolutely. no doubt about that. And so you started into, why did you leave that company? Why didn't you stay on board? I mean, it's still a fairly successful company, is it not?
It is. Yes. My skill, and at least the way I perceive myself, rightly or wrongly, is kind of as a guy who solves interesting and hard technology problems. I think that Rever was kind of turning from the type of company where it's got a bunch of technology problems into the type of company where it's got a bunch of business challenges that needed to be addressed. And so I felt that that kind of wasn't really my core competency. And also I'd developed an idea while at Rever, which I felt and feel was extremely compelling and addressing a pretty fundamental problem, and I wanted to pursue it. So,
well, that's a good lead-in, but I actually want to backtrack a little bit more before we talk about that, because I don't want to go into that in more detail. I'd really actually like to really understand what you did with Freenet.
Oh, sure.
What it came about and what it's doing today and all that sort of stuff.
Sure. Well, so Freenet, to give you the full story, while at university, I was studying artificial intelligence and computer science, I think I mentioned, and from a technology standpoint, I was very interested in this area called emergent systems. So examples of emergent systems would include an ant colony or a flock of birds or any situation where you've got a bunch of individually simple components, but when they interact with each other, they exhibit sophisticated, complicated behavior. And this fascinated me. And what fascinated me in particular was that nobody had really found much of a practical application for this in technology. Nature had found plenty of practical applications for emergent systems, but engineers had not. And so I was kind of really keen to find some kind of practical way to apply this concept. And at the same time, as I was learning about the Internet, and you would hear people say things like, oh, you know, the Internet roots around censorship and all this type of thing. And it turns out that's just rubbish. The Internet is very easy to censor. It's a lot cheaper to monitor people's email and other communications on the Internet than in virtually any other medium. And I realized this, and I thought, you know, even as people were living in this hippie kind of dream world where the Internet would be the answer to the ultimate tool for freedom of speech, I really started to worry that actually it could be opposite. It could really be a means for control. And I started to think about, you know, maybe there's some kind of way that you could layer a technology on top of the Internet that would allow people to communicate freely with each other without fear of censorship. And that means anonymously. If you're not anonymous, or at least don't have the option of being anonymous, then you cannot communicate freely because you can be punished for what you say. So I realized kind of, you know, had this epiphany that these two things that I was thinking about, one on the political side and the other on the technology side with emergent systems, could be combined. And that you could build something that was almost operated like an ant colony of software sitting on top of the Internet that will allow people to exchange information securely, anonymously, in a completely decentralized manner, just like an ant colony. And that, so kind of my two...
How do you mean
together.
Exchange information anonymously like an ant colony?
Well, it's decentralized like an ant colony. It doesn't exchange information anonymously.
So there's no central server, there's no central point at all. All the decisions are all just made locally by the player as they go up the day.
Exactly, just like an ant colony or a flock of birds. And it's essential to avoid any kind of centralization, because any kind of centralization can be used to attack or shut down the system.
I read about that sort of stuff for a number of years, and I haven't seen Freenet out there. I've certainly followed your work for a long time now, probably 8 years or something like that. I've been seeing what you're doing, but I don't see Freenet being talked about as this big thing. What is the actual end result? I mean, does it actually work properly when you don't have a decentralized core? Does it just mean that everything's slow?
It does work well. I mean, it's hard to build a decentralized system which scales, and this was kind of part of what was hard about Freenet. So we published a paper describing essentially our what we had developed, which was a decentralized, scalable way to exchange information. We published that paper back in 2000, and actually it was the most cited computer science paper of that year. Although at the same time, kind of Freenet was weird, because we were getting a lot of attention in mainstream press, mainly around the area of copyright. Like, how can you enforce copyright on a system where people can exchange information anonymously and where the system cannot be shut down. But it also generated interest in the academic press, and Freenet was an early example of what later became known as a distributed hash table, which is something that you kind of hear about quite a lot these days in computer science circles.
Can you tell us what a distributed hash table is?
So a hash table in computer science is a bit like a phone book. It's a data structure where you give it a key, let's say someone's name, and it'll give you a corresponding value, which is, let's say, their phone number. And hash tables are kind of a key component of pretty much any piece of software that you care to see. A distributed hash table is a hash table where the data is distributed over a large number of computers. So instead of keeping everything in one centralized place, it's actually distributed, you know, might be distributed among thousands of computers. And this whole concept grows out of something called small world theory. So you're probably familiar with the concept of a small world, or the 6 degrees of separation.
Mm-hmm.
And this comes from the idea that it's been discovered that you can get from any one person to any other person in about 6 steps, just traveling along relationships between those people. And this is the premise. This is why websites like LinkedIn and similar sites work quite well. But there's a whole area of mathematics behind small world theory, and it turns out that not any network, if you just take a bunch of things and randomly connect them together, they won't necessarily have the small world property. But human relationships do have a small world property. And this whole kind of concept of small world theory and the mathematics behind it is the underpinnings of both Freenet and the other distributed hash table technologies that followed it.
So what does it mean in the real world? Like, is Freenet, does that become like is that HTTP and FTP and other types of services that browse, that work on top of the internet that I can then use in an anonymous fashion?
Yes. So you can use HTTP with Freenet. So you can surf Freenet just as you would surf the World Wide Web, and you can actually use an ordinary web browser to do it. It is slower than the World Wide Web because there's a lot of cryptography going on, and your computer is talking to other people's computers directly, which is slower than talking to, let's say, Google's centralized servers. But yeah, so you can use HTTP over Freenet, people experimented with SMTP, the email protocol, over Freenet, and others as well. So Freenet is in itself a platform, and you can implement other services on top of Freenet, and people do.
How does it compare with Tor?
It is addressing a similar problem to Tor, however, its approach is quite different. So with Freenet, any participant, anyone who installs the Freenet software becomes part of the Freenet network. With Tor, there is still a separation between clients and servers. So Tor has a list of, I'm not sure what it is now, last time I looked, I think it was about 600 servers around the world. And when you connect to the Tor network, you're connecting to one of these servers. So Tor is more of a client-server model than Freenet.
Okay. So let's say I'm in China and I want to browse stuff that's against the Chinese government. Is that a safe thing to do, to sit there and do that over Freenet?
It depends on your definition of safe. We don't guarantee that you are 100% secure, but what we do is we say that it's safer than the alternatives. So typically what people in China do when they're not using a system like Freenet is they will connect via short-lived HTTP proxies where they really have very little protection from the Chinese government. As soon as the government becomes aware of these proxies, they can either shut them down immediately, very easily, or more insidiously, they can kind of sit there and watch who is connecting to these proxies. So we don't claim that Freenet is perfectly secure or that it is impossible that anyone would discover what you're doing with Freenet. But what we do say is, you know, look, here are the things that people are actually doing today, and these things are incredibly unsafe and incredibly insecure, and Freenet is a hell of a lot better than that.
And so from doing what you did with Freenet, how did that come that the guys from Deuce came to talk with you? I mean, you had done video at that point, or is that you had started with video then with Rev?
I got to know Yanis and Nicholas really because, you know, we both created peer-to-peer technologies, and so we got to know each other that way. Nobody had really built an effective peer-to-peer video distribution system, so there really wasn't much precedent for doing what we wanted to do. But I built peer-to-peer systems before, and at Upriser, I built a peer-to-peer content distribution system, and so it wasn't that big a leap from there to video.
And so, I mean, in the real world, does that really work? Watching TV and having it distributed across our machines, does it work well enough to be usable on a day-to-day basis?
I believe it works well. I believe it's working well for Juice. I think, in fact, I mean, I've been pretty busy, so I haven't followed their progress that closely, but I believe that they had some problems a couple of months ago where part of their network went down, and it actually turned out that it was part of their network that was being served from central servers went down, and the part of their system that still worked was the peer-to-peer aspect of it. So I think so far Juiced is having a good experience with the peer-to-peer approach.
And I guess maybe it works better because it's broadcast and not transmission back and forth, so there's less stress on the system, latency becomes less of an issue.
Yes, exactly. Well, yes, so with broadcast, it means that the clients in the system can kind of build up a buffer of data, so they can buffer, like, you know, 5 or 10 seconds of video, which means that if a piece goes missing, they have time to try to replace it. Right. And if they can't replace it, it's not the end of the world because most video protocols are tolerant of data loss.
So why don't you just tell us a little bit about the startup you're doing now and the kind of problem that you're working on solving today?
Sure. So really the basic idea behind Soof is to figure out quickly what people are interested in and present them with things that will appeal to them. I did some work on this type of thing at Rever, where, of course, we were very interested in figuring out what kind of videos people were interested in and presenting those videos to them. And I actually developed collaborative filters, which is kind of the classic way to solve this problem. I developed two collaborative filters for Rever, one of which we licensed to a company called Reddit, which was later purchased by Condé Nast. And I realized while kind of working on this problem at Rever that actually collaborative filters were not a good solution. And that kind of made me realize that there was a real opportunity to create a type of recommendation engine that addressed what I perceived to be the key problems with collaborative filters.
That's totally contrary to what I'm seeing. I mean, one of the best examples I can think of is Pandora, which started out with its music recommendation based around the content of the music and finding music with similar rhythms. And I think they admitted, I don't know, six or 12 months ago, that they realized that, in fact, that wasn't going to provide the best recommendations and moving more towards a collaborative filtering model. If collaborative filtering isn't the best way, what is?
Well, the key problem with collaborative filtering, and I'm not saying that collaborative filtering doesn't work. I'm saying that it has a key flaw, which is that collaborative filters require a lot of data about users before they can effectively recommend to those users. Now, in some applications, that's not a serious problem. So, for example, if you're Amazon and you've got a very large user base and you can collect a lot of behavioral information about each of your users, then that's probably that's plenty enough information for a collaborative filter to figure out what those users are interested in. But most people are not in Amazon's situation. Most people have relatively little information about individual users, and for them, collaborative filters are of limited use. Typically, collaborative filters will do one of two things. So they'll use a user-based collaborative filter, which works by identifying similar users and then looking at what those users like that you haven't seen yet, and recommending those things to you. Now, that requires a lot of data before they can effectively find users that are similar to you. The other kind of collaborative filter works by is actually quite quick, but the reason it's quick is that it pigeonholes the user. So it will kind of assign properties to the user. So Pandora's previous algorithm that, as you said, you know, they admit that there are problems with it, fell into this category. So, you know, in Pandora's case, it might decide that you like female vocalists and that you like, you know, this type of beat, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem with that is that it'll kind of rapidly get into the ballpark of what you're interested in, but then it'll essentially pigeonhole you, sorry for the mixed metaphor, but you get pigeonholed inside a ballpark. And you're essentially stuck.
So I can't handle attention here. Tell me, what is it about?
So the difference with Soup's approach is that it's able to figure out what you're interested in based on relatively little data and based upon the type of data that, let's say, a website will have about a user right from the first moment that user visits a website or very shortly afterwards. So it's kind of like a meat grinder algorithm where you can give it whatever information is available to you about users, and it could be anything from this guy's a Firefox user, this guy's running Windows XP, this guy got here by clicking on a link on Boing Boing, this guy's geographic location is this person just purchased this thing, this was the first thing they clicked on. So literally any kind of information you happen to have about the user, you can feed into this algorithm, and the algorithm will spot patterns in user behavior and use those patterns to come up with an initial picture of what your interests are. And then as that user continues to use your website, you can feed in additional behavior that you collect about this user that they will find, you know, that will refine the system's idea of what that user's interest
is. Is this predictive analysis type stuff, like scorecarding, that kind of thing, or is it something totally different?
It's related to predictive analysis. So basically it's a inference engine of sorts. It looks for correlations in user behavior and combines that with an ontology of information about the things that are being recommended. So we actually built a news website as a way to kind of test this algorithm and demonstrate it. And so, for example, on our news website, let's say you click on a story about Hillary Clinton, then you click on a story about Barack Obama. What it would do is not only kind of do the naive thing, which is, okay, this person is more likely to be interested in Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, but it also looks at, well, who is Hillary Clinton? Who is Barack Obama? What do they have in common? Well, they're both 2008 Democratic presidential candidates, and it would make the inference that what you're actually interested in is 2008 Democratic presidential candidates. So it's using the knowledge that it has about metadata and how the metadata is associated with other metadata in order to very quickly come up with theories about what it is you're interested in.
So an advertising context that could work. An interesting thing I've been seeing people talk about on the net lately is the good advertising is advertising that you don't notice. And I think that the prime example of that is Google's pay-per-click ads. I mean, those ads, when you see them, they add value to what you're doing. And so we want them there. But generally, I think if people have a choice between seeing those ads or not seeing them, I think generally people will choose to see them because they add value. So that kind of concept is it's trying to be applied to behavioral targeting on the web. So there's browsing the web, all the banner inventory of this thing, instead of being retarded punch monkey type ads, you're actually seeing ads that add value to what you're doing and relate to what you're looking for. So there's a company called Blue Lithium that has gone in the fair direction with that, and they've been acquired by Yahoo.
Yes.
Is what you're talking about something that can be applied in that kind of context?
Yeah, so what we are doing, it's kind of horizontal technology, so it doesn't really care what it's recommending, but in a scenario where it's being applied to recommend advertising for users, it is a form of behavioral targeting, so it's similar to Blue Lithium or Dakota or Turn or a number of these companies. What's distinct about our technology, or at least we believe it's distinct about our technology, of course these guys don't exactly come out and tell you exactly how their stuff works, so it's hard to say anything definitive, but what I've noticed with a lot of these behavioral companies is they still kind of make this assumption that we've got a fair amount of information about users. And the way they justify that assumption is that, you know, they say, well, you know, if we're widely deployed, then, you know, we can tie users together even if it's the same user but on different websites. And so we'll be able to collect enough information about users to recommend effectively or to target effectively. And so in a sense, it seems like they may have the same problem that collaborative filters do, which is that they kind of have a bootstrapping issue in that they need to be very widely deployed in order to get enough information about users to recommend effectively. So our approach is tackling, when applied to advertising, it is behavioral targeting. The difference is that we're kind of humble in the sense that we don't assume that we're so widely deployed that when we see a user, you know, we've got a bucket of information about them. We assume that we may have very little information about them. And our technology is optimized to taking that small amount of information and turning it into a useful profile of what is this user most likely to find interesting.
So in a case where we do have a lot of information, for example, we're Amazon.com, and we're launching some new type of behavioral targeting, something of some kind, the fact is, even though we don't have much data today, we can turn it on, and tomorrow we're going to have a lot of data. So in those kind of instances, would you suggest that traditional collaborative filtering is enough? But in the case of a startup that's just getting going that doesn't have a lot of data, then your solution is appropriate.
Well, I think our solution is more differentiated in a scenario where you don't have much information. But I think it's hard because we are pretty young, and so we don't have solid numbers, comparative numbers to point to. But I do believe that our technology will bring something new to a scenario where you do have a lot of data. And so I believe that it will be extremely competitive with existing behavioral targeting solutions, even in scenarios where you do have a lot of information. But I don't yet have the data to prove it.
Right, okay. And can you talk about exactly how you're basing that, or is that the secret sauce?
Well, it is the secret sauce. So I can't go into too much detail, but I can kind of what I can say is that what distinguishes us is firstly the fact that our system has a pretty good understanding of what is being recommended. So I gave the example in the case of news how it would actually understand that a news story was about Barack Obama, and it would understand who Barack Obama is, and it's able to draw inferences on that basis. Now, in the case of, let's say, product recommendation, the metadata that you would have about the product, perhaps its color, perhaps its price, its manufacturer, obviously, and other relevant characteristics about the product, you would give this information to our algorithm, and it would actually be able to use that metadata instead of just looking at the product as kind of, here is item 387545, and the only thing you really know about it is who bought it and who didn't. So I believe we're bringing something new to a scenario where you have a lot of user behavioral information as well, but we're still too young to prove that. But certainly in a case where a licensee of our technology needs to deal with users that they may never have seen before, and they want to recommend effectively to users that they have not seen before, that's really where our technology is primarily differentiated.
So if I want to come to you and license your technology, how does that work?
So we have an API, XML-RPC API, which is, we've worked hard to make it very easy to integrate with. You sign our license agreement, and we give you access to this API, and then whether your site is built in Java or PHP or Ruby on Rails or whatever it is, all of those platforms are very easy to integrate with XML-RPC. And very, very simply, you just send us the information that you send us whatever information you have, and you send us information about whatever it is you're recommending to users, be it products or be it ads or be it news stories, and we will send you back a list of for a given user, we will send you back a list of the things that user is most likely to find interesting.
End up teaching things within different niches, or is it just generic?
It will learn within different niches. So when you deploy it on your website, it might take an hour or two to learn about your user base and learn about the products that you're recommending. So it adapts to particular niches. It's generic. It's a generic technology in and of itself, and it adapts automatically. We don't have to go in and tell it, you know, all about you as a licensee. It will learn about you and how.
In an example you used earlier, like of clicking on a Hillary news item and then an Obama news item, how does it learn then that they're both Democrat contenders for the presidency?
Oh, I see. So in that situation, we tell it. Yeah. So that kind of the ontology. So we call that our ontology, and we have a huge database of data about data. And literally any topic you can imagine, our system will understand that topic, you know, will know what it is, will, if you give the name of a tree, it'll know it's a tree, it'll know what phylum it's in, it'll know what trees are similar, et cetera, et cetera. So we already have a massive database of information about every topic under the sun. And that's kind of what you use. So that's not, and then the system will kind of augment that and adapt it on the fly, but we've already got that.
Okay, so let's say I come to you then and I want to work with you and I understand technology. How do you charge me? How much does it cost?
Well, so I can't disclose our charging structure. But if that's kind of later in the process, and it kind of depends on the specific vertical as well, because different verticals have different economics. But the basic approach is we would charge you much like, and this may or may not be a flattering way to describe it, but we charge you in much the same way that a cell phone carrier charges you. So it's on the basis of usage, and then a component of the charging structure is on the basis of how effective the technology is. So are people actually buying the products that we're recommending? Are people actually clicking on the things that we're recommending? So it's a pay-per-use structure, but I can't get into the actual numbers.
And I guess you're just getting started. But you're obviously a fun startup. But at some point, would you be open to licensing the whole thing out as well, or is it all going to be pay-per-usage?
Well, as you say, we're pretty early in the game. So it would depend on the deal.
Right. Cool. Anything else you'd like to add in closing that we haven't talked about? We should.
I don't think anything brings to mind.
Cool. Well, Ian, thanks very much for making time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I just turned that recorder off. Good stuff, dude. That was a great interview.
Oh, well, thank you. I was
really interesting.
I didn't ramble.
You did, but with interesting rambling. That's why, because otherwise I would have jumped in and like asked more questions. But yeah, what you're talking about was really interesting stuff.
Oh,
good job.
Good.
And it's possible some of my guys could be interested in licensing that. We'll see once it goes out there, see what they come to. But there's definitely potential there. I guess talk with Martin a little bit about working with him.
Sure. Yeah, so Martin, off the record, Martin, we're in a conversation about him being one of our licensees, and maybe he mentioned that to you.
Yeah, that's what he said.
Yeah, so it's interesting, but we are early stage, and we're in a learning process, and I'm fairly new to in particular the kind of product recommendation behavioral targeting market. So I'm very interested in having conversations with people and learning more about it.
All right. Well, so you understand what I do and how this works is I drive referrals. If you've read Malcolm Gladwell's book, he talks about connectors. Mm-hmm. And I'm a connector. I just know a lot of people. I use these interviews to kind of help push that as well. Mm-hmm. And so there'll be a cocktail happening at AdTech, which is the big advertising conference in April in San Francisco, which you'll be invited to. I have people then that pay to become members of my program. They get these interviews. They get four or five of these sorts of interviews every month with the full audio, the transcript, and then the contact information. And I can be there to help facilitate something. So, for example, let's say a guy really liked what you spoke about, but he may be in doing something completely different and not able to communicate with you. And I understand a little bit about your face, and I spend a fair amount of time open source and free software, and I get along with Richard Stallman. I can sometimes.
Oh my God, you're the one.
No, well, I'm exaggerating this. I'll yeah, good.
Someone gets on well with Richard Stallman.
Okay, sometimes I get on well with him. I've got pretty pissed off with him too. you're exactly right to call me on that. But no, I do. I can send an email and get answers from him, and occasionally get help from him with stuff. I've helped him with some bits and pieces. So that's an absolute exaggeration, but you make a good point. What I do to join my program is they pay me. It's $9.95 a month for effectively these kinds of referrals. And this is not something that I'm pitching to you. I just want you to be aware that it's there. Mm-hmm. You'll be invited to come to the cocktail. You basically get one for instance. You can come in San Francisco and meet these guys. And if you want to get involved, you can. And if you don't want to be involved, that's fine too. But just so you know that it's there.
Oh, well, I really appreciate that. And in a kind of scenario where you're kind of facilitating people to talk to each other, how do people make that worth your while? How are you rewarded for your efforts?
That's where they join my program and they pay me $9.95 a month.
Oh,
and so then as I find stuff. So in this case, like for yours right now, what you've talked about is something I've never heard of before. But I'll just take that away and think about it. And if I can think of any of my guys who that's going to add a ton of value to them, and I know that's a problem that they're trying to solve, I'll introduce them to you. So here's where you should talk to Ian and, go and have at it. You're then on the outside of the network, and so I'll bring stuff for guys who want to value them. If you become a part of this, then I'll be more actively thinking on how can I pull drive business towards you as well.
I understand. Well, that definitely sounds interesting. I mean, to be honest with you, we're kind of still pretty in scrappy startup mode, so it may be a little bit early for us for that type of thing, but I think it would definitely make a lot of sense perhaps after we've raised our next round of funding.
Sure. Well, it'd be an honor to have you involved. Going through the conversation that we just had, the referral that stands out, that if there's any way you can pull off, would be awesome. The Skype guys, is there any chance you could get me an interview with either of those guys?
I could try. They're they're kind of, as you might imagine, it's extremely difficult to get them to agree to anything like that. They're really bombarded. So I won't make any promises, but I will, I'll put an email and see what happens. But I've tried before without success, get them into, not what you're doing, similar things. And it's, from their point of view, I think they feel a bit besieged.
All I'm asking is for an hour on the phone with either of them. There's no charge. There's no pressure to do anything. It's just an interview. But what it does do, they had people out of AdTech in San Francisco. They put them in front of some of the absolute top people in the advertising community because they're on the list.
Yeah, I will. I think it should be interesting to them. I'll put an email. I'll also give it some thought about other people. I do know Bram Cohen. I don't know him that well. I've kind of met him a few times at conferences and things. But I could put an email out to him.
I know he's got Asperger's, so I guess he's a little bit like Stallman. Do you think he would be an easy interview, or would he be a little bit difficult?
Good question. I don't know. It's probably not too bad because your style is kind of straight to the point, which I think he might appreciate. I mean, you kind of ask pretty straight questions, which I think might actually work well. He tends to kind of, what's difficult for him is if people beat around the bush.
Oh, yeah.
But if people get straight to the point, if you ask him a straight question, he'll give you a straight answer, and it'll generally be...
If you could introduce me to him, that would be great. Who would be someone else that comes to mind, especially what are interesting guys that are running stuff that has a lot of traffic? Although, I guess since you're in the peer-to-peer world, I mean maybe even any of the major peer-to-peer clients, that'd be interesting, because I don't know anyone that well at all.
How about, I know the guys behind LimeWire.
Oh, yeah, that'd be awesome.
I could ask them. I also know, I know the guys behind StumbleUpon.
Yeah.
Which was sold to eBay. They're kind of in crazy land as well, I think. They're kind of in, crap, we've been acquired and everything's gone crazy land.
All right.
So I'm not sure about them, but I think the LimeWire guys are pretty accessible in my experience.
Those guys would probably find it interesting because they're always looking for advertisers, and I have a lot of advertisers on my list.
Yeah, let me just make a quick note so I don't forget. I'll try Yanis, although I'm not optimistic about him. LimeWire, I'll give a shot, and I'll try Bram.
Yeah.
I can't make any promises, but we'll see what comes out.
And the best way we found is just sending them an email and copying me, and then I'll follow up with them.
Okay.
But, however you're comfortable with is fine.
Okay, well, I may just send Yanis a private email first, because I think he might feel pressured otherwise. We'll see. But I'll think about how best to do it in each case.
Sure thing. And is it okay if I go ahead and add you to my list of interviews so you see them as I publish them to it?
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for your time, sir. That was a really good interview. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, well, I'm glad. Thank you.